Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and I am back in the Betsy Trotwood Pub in England, as there's a strange low rumbling going on. I am here with Alex Frith. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Eamon. Always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure. This one we've organised, I don't know how long ago. We missed the summer one, so it's later in the year for us than usual. And this, we worked out, we think this is your sixth appearance on the book club.
If you include the film club.
Include the film club. And therefore you have become a member of the five-star club, and you've got your T-shirt today.
Woo! Yeah, I have it in my hand, but not rustling. And it's a wonderful thing.
We had, this is Giles Wright's idea, so we've now got T-shirts for the five-star club. If you reach five appearances on the book club or the film club, you get a T-shirt now. I don't know what else the T-shirt gets you. There's no other exclusive access or anything like that.
Well, if people spot me on the street in it.
Yes, or at conventions.
Secret handshake. Yeah.
Anyway, welcome to the five-star T-shirt club. Let's get to it. Tell us, you've brought us back to 2000 AD, which I've wandered off piste away from for a bit. What are we covering today?
We're covering one of kind of the mid-period greats of 2000 AD. It's Necronauts by Gordon Rennie and Fraser Irving from the year 2001, I think.
Right.
And it's quite a short book, but it is really genuinely one of the better sort of series that 2000 AD has ever done. And it's one of those ones where it tells a story and it ends and there's not like people are crying out for a sequel because the story doesn't demand it. Every now and then 2000 AD does some really kind of nice 10, 12 episode stories that just feel good on their own. And I think this is one that at the time was much celebrated, but has perhaps been kind of overshadowed by more modern things. But don't forget Necronauts, it's still good.
Yeah, it doesn't get... I mean, because there was a poll recently on Facebook about scariest stories from 2000 AD, and of course Necronauts doesn't get mentioned.
No, I mean, that's an interesting thought. It is a horror story, and perhaps there are bits of it that it has got scary moments in it, but maybe when you think of scariest stuff, it's hard to look past sort of John Smith's flesh-ripping, yes, gory things, for example.
Okay, well, let's do the facts and figures. As you say, from 2001, Progs 2001, and then Progs 1223 to 1230, written by Gordon Rennie, art by Fraser Irving, letters by Tom Frame. I had down that this was under Matt Smith's reign, but you quite rightly pointed out that this was...
Well, it's commissioned by Andy Diggle, so I'm guessing it's one of those things where Diggle kind of helped shepherd it in whatever sense the 2000 AD editors are hands-on, but it was probably printed in Matt Smith's tenure. In fact, I was trying to look up some kind of background on it, and Gordon Rennie says that he had originally kind of dreamed up the idea in the very early 90s, and it was going to run in one of those kind of adult comics that had a small boom in like 1990-91. So he did a story called White Trash,
right,
and it was going to be the follow-up to that. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen, and he kind of sat on it for nearly 10 years. And he says that as a result, it's much better. So, but it's interesting that he had the idea that long ago, because, I mean, we haven't really sort of talked about what the story's about, but it's a type of story that has become quite fashionable,
right,
since then. But,
yeah,
you know, in 1990, it was a much more novel idea, I think.
Okay. So before we get to it, you've got the paperback, which is now out of print.
Yes, I guess it was a Rebellion printing quite soon after it ran in the prog, and it's unusual in that it's the same size as the prog, so it's a nice big paperback, whereas the modern ones tend to kind of shrink them a bit.
Yeah, more down to American size, yeah. I've got the digital of Tharg's Terror Tales from 2015, which includes this story and then some other bits and pieces of Fraser Irving stories, and Gordon Rennie as well, just shorter stories, which we might mention if we have time, but we'll see. Okay, let's get to it. So first of all, let's do the setup, because,
yes,
you know, interesting. Tell us the setup of Necronauts.
So Necronauts is an imaginary kind of meeting of sort of four famous figures from the early 1900s who are all interested in the kind of the spirit realm and the occult. So you have Harry Houdini, the kind of more famous as being a kind of a magician and sort of doing like escape acts, but he was also someone who did a lot of kind of debunking of kind of spiritualists and seances and mediums. And it imagines that he's good friends with Arthur Conan Doyle, again, most famous as the author of the Sherlock Holmes novels, but also quite celebrated for being someone who was super into seances, and he really believed it, or at least wanted to believe it. And they kind of both have slightly kind of spooky kind of things happen to them at a similar time, and they get kind of joined together with H.P. Lovecraft, who in this story has not yet started kind of writing his kind of famous novels about like eldritch other dimensional beings who cause kind of madness and horror, and also Charles Fort, who I guess is probably the least famous of the four now, but he is an American. I think he was sort of technically kind of a sort of journalist slash author, but basically he was someone who collected stories of kind of weird paranormal stuff, and he kind of popularized it in a couple of books and became so known for doing this that there's still a magazine called the Fortean Times, which is called Fortean, as in things that would have interested Charles Fort. That's literally what that word means. So the four of these people together basically team up and have an adventure that involves kind of crossing the barrier between life and death and mixing it up with, unsurprisingly, the kind of like eldritch beings that Lovecraft wrote about in his real books.
Yes. Okay, so yes, they've got a very dark threat that the four of them have to defeat together or go up against together.
Yes.
And if we go in reverse order, Charles Fort, as you say, he's like sort of Fox Mulder, but without, you know, it doesn't work for the FBI. He collected all these weird happenings and stories.
Yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah. And then possibly, I don't know whether he collected objects as well, but essentially he wrote a couple of compendiums of like, hey, this is kind of a weird story. And it's interesting that he seemed to be a sort of character who was kind of deliberately wrote about it in a way to make it sound very believable, but perhaps himself was a bit more of a skeptic, but wanted to kind of, because he just thought these are super interesting things.
I want to believe, yeah.
So yeah, as you say, very Fox Mulder.
We've got Lovecraft, who is, he's the nerviest of the four characters.
Yes.
And as you say, it's before Lovecraft becomes...
I think it's meant to be. We're introduced to him sitting in his kind of house and writing something, but it's not completely clear if he's already known as an author of this stuff, or is he just like a kind of a weird recluse who kind of gets wind of these kind of like goings on.
And then we finally, of course, we've got Conan Doyle and Houdini, who did actually, I know these two did meet, they were friends, they did share an interest in, as you say, the spiritualism side of things, but with different viewpoints about it. And they have sort of, that friendship has sort of inspired other fictions. I know that people put them into sort of Conan Doyle and Houdini detective type shows.
Yes,
like that.
Yeah. This, I mean, I feel like since Necronauts came out, I mean, the biggest sort of thing that people might think of when they hear is like, oh, four famous people from the sort of 19th, 20th century teaming up to fight monsters. Isn't that a bit League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Yeah.
And of course, that one is about fictional characters banding together, where these are all real people.
Yeah.
And indeed, Rennie had this idea before the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was written. Not that that kind of means anything, because lots of people have the same idea at the same time. But since then, the idea of like teaming up either real or fictional or both of them seems to become a thing that people like to do. And it's fun. And there's another quite similar comic from a couple of years after Necronauts called The Five Fists of Science, written by Matt Fraction. Unfortunately, I forgot the name of the artist who drew it. It's an Image comic.
Right.
And that teams up kind of Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla, mostly kind of against Marconi is the kind of the sort of villain. But again, there's a similar thing, because Marconi comes up in this story as someone who more or less invented the radio so that he could tune in to the voices of the dead, and that kind of comes up in the Necronaut story. So Five Fists of Science isn't at all like Necronaut. It's not a horror story, but it is a kind of action story, and it's very much tapping into the idea that with the discovery of radios and x-rays and things, there was a real interest in the idea that maybe humans could solve the mystery of what happens after you die. We have not yet solved this mystery.
No, although in this book they sort of solve it. But anyway, and I'll just mention quickly Tesla. I get, I have a slight aversion to Tesla because it just seems like now it's the one that they go to. Oh yes, he was a genius.
Yeah, it's true.
Who had all the answers. Yeah,
yeah. And of course, he comes up in the Prestige.
That's yes. Well, exactly.
So that's a similar sort of like feeling to Necronauts as well.
He's appeared in Doctor Who as well. Mm. Yeah. I was quite interested by this idea of putting together real characters. I'm not sure that Lovecraft and Charles Fort ever did actually meet.
I've got no idea. I mean, I've not read kind of particularly widely about any of the four of them, but it does feel to me like Rennie and Irving have both made an effort to try and capture actually what they look like and what we know of their personalities and interests. So I wouldn't say this is a kind of a resource for learning about these four characters, but I think it takes fewer liberties with them than you might think.
Right.
You know.
Okay. I was, as you know from our notes, I was trying to find examples of other real-life characters that had been put together in fictional settings. And this is terribly embarrassing because it occurred to me that Alan Davis had drawn Sherlock Holmes in Batman. And I thought to myself, hang on a minute, neither of those are real.
I know what you mean, though. They become, I can imagine, in 100 years' time, people might think Sherlock Holmes was a real detective.
Absolutely, I'm sure there are people who think that was real, yeah. We've sort of covered it already, but if I go back a bit, why this one particularly for the book club?
Well, two reasons, and it's basically specifically to do with the art and the writing. So on the writing side, I feel like Gordon Rennie has written a lot for 2000 AD and the Judge Red magazine. And somehow he doesn't seem to get the love and kind of like fond admiration of other writers. And I don't know, I'm sure some of his work has been covered. I guess you've done Jaeger at some point.
Yes, we've done Jaeger.
And you might have done some Cabalistics, or maybe not.
Cabalistics is coming up on the podcast. Yeah. He's obviously done Absalom, hasn't he?
Yes.
And we've done that. But Cabalistics will come up at some point.
But basically, I thought it's about time he got some more kind of exploration on the book club. And then Fraser Irving, it's definitely notable that when Necronauts kind of came out, it wasn't Irving's first work to see print in 2000 AD, but I think from reading around it, it might have been his first commission. And just because it was a longer story, and while he was waiting for scripts, possibly, he did a couple of Future Shocks and a Judge Dredd, maybe. But I definitely remember kind of opening the prog with Necronauts in it, and it's just like, this art is something else.
Yes.
It really kind of sticks the story in the mind. So not to take away from the writing side, but it's definitely, I think when people think of Necronauts, remember it, it's probably the sort of shock of the new of what Irving's art style was like. And then he went on to do a bunch of stuff to D&D and then immediately left for America and hasn't been seen since. I mean, that's not quite fair. But, you know, when you're good at art and you're in demand, that's what you do.
I have met him at Lawless in Bristol a couple of years ago, I think. I can't imagine that this artwork was particularly quick to produce. There might have been, you know, this took some time, I would assume.
Yeah.
We'll go into that in a moment, about how detailed it is. If we stick with Gordon Rennie's writing for a moment. Now, heroesof2000ad.blogspot.com, is that right? Number 15, Gordon Rennie,
yes,
in the Heroes of 2000 AD.
I mean, bearing in mind, when I've been writing the Heroes of 2000 AD blog, which I have not updated for many years at this point, the numbers have changed.
Yes.
So whether he's still the 15th most prolific contributor, I'm not sure, but he's up there. And certainly his numbers have only been going up. But weirdly, I think since I kind of wrote the entry on Gordon Rennie, I don't know, five more years ago,
yeah,
he's been doing more work, and I think he's one of those kind of authors who kind of gets better and better as he goes with 2000 AD. And at the time of Necronauts, this was like miles away the best thing that he'd done, and it was like, yes, this guy who's been kind of working away. He'd done Missionary Man, which is pretty good but kind of slightly ropey in places, and then he kind of fairly famously was doing a lot of Dread one-off stories when John Wagner and Alan Grant kind of were too busy to do the whole year of it. And he was widely held to be like, oh yeah, this is a guy who can actually write Dreads as well as the Masters. But he sort of slowed down on that. I get the impression because he got a bit bored of it and didn't really like it.
Right.
But anyway, he comes along with Necronauts and it's great. And then since then, he's kind of launched more and more series. And he's kind of a go-to guy for like 2000 AD, give us something new. So he's the most kind of immediate obvious following is the Cabalistics Inc.
Yes.
thing, which is a similar horror-ish thing. And then where that has all made up characters, the stories tend to explore a mix of kind of stories that come from British kind of TV and film, particularly like Hammer type stuff.
Right.
And then like Absalom is a sort of spin-off of Cabalistics. And then recently Diabolics has kind of picked up the surviving cast of Cabalistics and is doing more of this. kind of what can we do with kind of horror tropes of the 60s, 70s and 80s. But also, you know, he did a lot of stuff with Rogue Trooper, and Jaeger is his kind of biggest success in that.
Yeah.
And Aquila is his kind of his modern update of the old Black Hawk strip. Is I think is another one that's really good and kind of underappreciated. Like maybe because it doesn't kind of get to run quite that often, which is probably a mix of the art taking a long time because it's Roman soldiers and horses. And also I think, again, from sort of trying to look at what Gordon Rennie's output has been like, he seems to be one of those writers who basically waits until he's got the story in mind that he wants to tell and then tells it. He doesn't kind of push himself to kind of churn stuff out, I think. So, which is maybe one reason why his output is actually quite a lot higher than some people, because he doesn't seem to kind of do bad stories for the sake of it. I mean, you could argue that some of his early work on the kind of Future Shocks and Vector 13s, I think, was his thing, were maybe not all kind of winners.
Right.
But I think in general, he does seem to be one of those authors who won't kind of churn out a series as quick as he can. He'll be like, right, I've got the stories to tell, I'll tell them. And then there's going to be a really big gap. And I suspect that's not because he's not getting work. It's because he's waiting and saying, sorry, Tharg, I haven't got the story yet, but when it comes, I'll give it to you. This is pure speculation.
Well, we'll talk about pure speculation in just a moment, because I'll say that at the time you wrote the blog, he was at the time, I think, third most prolific Dread writer behind Wagner and Grant.
Yeah, that sounds right. And I think that's not the case anymore.
Right.
Okay. I suspect that Rob Williams have caught up with him, but maybe Michael Carroll and in the last few years, Ken Niemand has really kind of, he's basically the kind of doing it all now.
Yeah, so Ken Niemand is interesting, and I don't know the answer to who Ken Niemand is.
I don't.
No, okay.
I like to believe that it's a non-mystery, that we're pretending is a mystery.
We're pretending it's a pseudonym, but it might actually be somebody called Ken Niemand. Let's hope it is. Let's hope it is, or, you know, whatever. And of course, Gordon Rennie has, like, a few people, has stepped away from 2000 at times and then seemed to come back.
Mm.
He is a bit like when we talked about True Faith. Garth Ennis had that interest and still does in sort of religious or faith.
Mm.
Rennie has that, but he also, as you say, he has that interest in what we now call Fortiana.
Yeah, absolutely. He, I mean, that's what Necronauts is kind of all about and what the Kabbalistics thing is all about.
Yeah.
And, you know, faith and what happens after death are quite combined.
Yeah.
And he clearly likes history as well, so I suspect that some of that he will have used those 10 years of gestating Necronauts to maybe do more research than others might on what the trappings of the world were like. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
He's also famously grumpy and doesn't do many interviews. The most recent interview that I could find was from sort of 2014.
Right.
Although it's interesting that at that time, one of the things he said in it was that Necronauts is possibly the work that he's proudest of.
Oh, really?
Which he may have, you know, since then kind of written things that he's even more proud of. I haven't mentioned, for example, things like Survival Geeks, which I think is a rare modern 2000 AD comedy story that is actually funny and people like it.
Yeah, it works. Yeah, I've always liked Survival Geeks. I forget who's the artist on Survival Geeks. Is it
Neil Gooch, I think.
Thank you.
And also interesting that Rennie has this reputation for being super grumpy, which may or may not be earned. I've never spoken to him, but he's collaborated a lot with Emma Beebe on that. He collaborated, I guess, with his son on Mechastopheles, or unless it's his brother or something.
Right.
And I think, I'm trying to think of someone else he's collaborated. He's, you know, he handed over the reins of the 86ers to Arthur Wyatt. So for someone who's got a reputation of being grumpy, he seems to be quite happy to work with other people.
I have met him at a sign-in, and he was perfectly, he was not at all grumpy. Okay. He seemed perfect then. But yes, he does have that strange reputation.
Maybe he's cultivating it on purpose.
Okay, keep us away. Yeah, keep us at bay. Quite right, too. Okay, well, let's turn to another hero of 2000 AD at number 74 on the blog. Again, 5 years ago. But although, as you say, in the last 5 years, he's probably not done anything at all for 2000 AD.
No, he might have done a cover.
Right.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fraser Irwin. Yeah, let's talk about him. He first appeared in the prog the year before this started. He has got, I find it interesting because he can change his styles for the story. We've done the Simpin detective.
Mm, that's very different style.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It's very different to this. Tell us a little bit about the black and white artwork in Necronauts.
So, it's it's a mixture, I think, of kind of penciled work and inked work. And there are bits where the characters, kind of, some of the characters end up in the kind of world of the dead or the spirit world. And he deliberately chose to illustrate some bits of that in pencil to kind of make it look more like another world, and then other bits in kind of really thick inks. And he said that he was going for a sort of like woodcut etching style that you might have found in kind of early 20th century kind of engravings. I don't know what they would have been. I mean, maybe even comics. And basically, he does a lot of lines. He draws lots of lines, and then he colours them in different thicknesses of ink. And it all feels like it's very deliberate and takes a lot of work. But even saying that, actually, when you look at his pages, they often feel kind of noticeably kind of spare. Like he's got a real gift for design. So that he'll lay things out on the page so you can see the information. And well, on the one hand, you think, my God, you must have drawn a lot of lines to do that. Also, the whole thing doesn't feel cluttered. It's right. Like he's not filling it up with detail necessarily. He's kind of filling it up with, I don't know what you call it. Basically, it works really well. And there's a few pages in here where you can see some really kind of neat storytelling tricks. And just simple things like you can imagine sort of the Gordon Rennie's kind of panel description might have said, you know, this character in the foreground, that character in the background, and kind of give a sense of like space between them. And Irving seems to have a real knack for just exactly getting the right amount of space and knowing when to show a silhouette of a character versus when to show them with a bit of, you know, detail showing so you can see their expression. And it really kind of adds to the mood. So he brings the horror, basically. Like Necronauts, I don't find any comic scary to read, if I'm honest. Right. And this one, not either. But the art in particular does kind of really tell you, this is a scary bit, something's happened. You can see that this character has kind of had a moment of realization, and it's, if you put yourself in their position, it would be terrifying.
Yeah.
And for me, that's as kind of close as comics get to horror, really.
Yeah.
Do you find them scary, Eamon?
Well, I think I've talked about this on the pod before. I've certainly talked about it on Tony Esmond's Never Run Anything podcast. I did find Alan Moore's Run on Swamp Thing scary. Something about that really disturbed me, some of the early stories. But yes, it is interesting. You know, some of the stuff we talk about on the pod is disturbing. Cradle Grave is very disturbing.
Yes, yeah, that's the
and John Smith. What's the
Killing Time?
Killing Time.
Which actually we should have mentioned, that is about Jack the Ripper, who was a real person.
There we
who may have become a fictional person.
Yes.
These days.
But who has now become a tulpa or something like that, a spiritual creation or something. Anyway, I mean, it is one of the shorter stories that we've covered in a way, which is great. You know, nice to have a short one to read. The story is great. I think it works really well. As you say, I didn't find it particularly scary, but I thought the artwork was just superb. So many lines, but as you say, in the right places.
Yes, exactly.
He seems to have done so much work on this. And also, particularly Houdini and maybe the younger Lovecraft, the faces I thought were quite good. I'm not sure I've ever seen a picture of Charles Fort, so I don't know about.
I mean, he had a moustache and glasses.
Yeah, so. Okay, it was the 1920s, yeah. Moustache and glasses, yeah. But yeah, it's terrific. I mean, it's so detailed in places. There's the what would we call it? There's another realm battlefield, as it were, or whatever, you know, that they sort of project Houdini's spirit form into.
He basically dreams himself into this kind of like death realm.
Yeah, and then in those, some of those pages are just breathtaking in terms of the sort of weirdness and the, you know, the amount of pen strokes that he's put on the page is just wonderful. He, of course, Fraser Irvine also did Judge Death stories.
Yeah, so that came next. And definitely, if anyone is kind of familiar with Fraser Irving's work from more recent stuff on 2000 AD or in his American comics, you might look at Necronauts and think, this isn't quite as good. And that's partly, like, particularly some of his faces and figure work, you can sort of see that it's an artist who's kind of learning what they're doing, and they would get better. And for me, his work on the two Judge Death stories is a level up of being better than the art on Necronauts. But actually what he does on Necronauts feels so kind of original in kind of comics language that I still get the kind of thrill from looking at it.
Yeah.
But I do think when he was using the same tricks on Judge Death, he'd kind of, you know, improved a bit more, which is what you expect.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, yes. I mean, we will probably get to those Judge Death stories at some point on the pod, hopefully. But yeah, this is, for very early in his 2000 AD career, this is just like breathtaking stuff, I thought. And it was really good to go back and read it again, particularly with, having to pay attention this time.
Yeah, it's true.
And it was terrific, yeah.
And it does feel like a style that hasn't really been copied by other people.
Yeah.
So Gordon Rennie worked with Dom Reardon on Cabalistics, and he's also got a very distinctive, like, horror-friendly style where he knows how to use empty space to convey, there's something missing from this page, and I'm a bit scared to think about what it is that I'm not seeing.
Right.
Which is usually a person off-panel being eviscerated by a kind of demon in human form. But it's not at all like Irving's style, because Reardon does kind of quite just sort of outlines of things,
right,
lots of white space, whereas Irving would fill it up with black or with lines. But I think the key thing that Irving does, and does it a lot in Necronauts, is he'll draw a figure, and then instead of filling in the rest of the panel with the details of what's in their study or what kind of monsters are attacking them, he'll use the lines to kind of convey the sense that this figure is now feeling anguish or bravado or kind of intense feelings of anything. And that feels like something that kind of manga does from time to time, but you don't really see much in British and American comics. It's just using the lines to kind of give you an emotion.
Oh, that's interesting, because yes, it is manga-esque in places, particularly, as you say, a single figure surrounded by lines and maybe not much in the way of a background. That's very manga-esque, isn't it?
Yeah, though in manga they tend to do that to show things like something moving really fast, or yes, a person like about to throw a punch.
Yeah.
But he does do it a bit for those things, but he mostly does it for like, oh, this is what a face looks like when it's stared into the abyss.
Okay, fascinating stuff. So let's go back to the story for a moment. There's the four of them. They've got to send Houdini's sort of sleeping form into this realm to battle the bad.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really talked about the story at all, actually, the details. So it starts off with Houdini practicing for a big escape trick that involves him more or less kind of shutting his body down to the point of death for as many minutes as he can. And in doing this, he encounters some kind of otherworldly spirits that then think, oh, there's a living host here that we can use to claw our way into the world. So in a sense, the story is that Houdini, by constantly pushing the limits of what humans can survive, is inadvertently opening a gateway to allow kind of evil ones into the world. And he's pushed it so far that they're going to succeed. And that's when the others kind of come to him and say, look, this is coming for you, and we need to kind of to stop it. And Houdini being Houdini, he's like, well, I'm not going to run away from it. Instead, I'm going to work out how to enter this plane on purpose and attack the demons that are trying to kind of claw their way through me.
Poor Lovecraft is having terrible dreams as a result, isn't he?
About, yes.
As we would say, elder gods or the dark ones or whatever, any particular favourite moments from the story itself?
So the very opening chapter and has got two amazing moments, which I think is one of the reasons why it stood out. And one is the sort of the image of Houdini kind of trying to... He's in this sort of semi-dead state, and he's got these kind of spirits snaking their way around his body, and he's kind of pulling, he's rendered, this is a bit where sort of Irving draws, I think, in pencil maybe, to show that they're kind of spirits, not human, and he's kind of trying to reach up into the thick blackness of back to the real world. And then at the end of the first episode, there's a scene with Conan Doyle at a seance where he's kind of again hoping that it will be true but not knowing, and then the medium in this instance is confronted by a vision so horrific he kind of literally rips his own face off, which is one of those things that actually, if you look at the picture, there's a couple of pictures both of the moment of it and the aftermath, are like, if you find drawings of horrible things horrific, they will scare you.
That is a particularly gruesome and shocking moment,
That somehow, that's also, it's like it's a very 2000 AD thing, I think, like every now and then you turn a page in 2000 AD and something just grotesque is happening, and someone's drawn it in really loving detail, and you think, yes, this is what 10-year-old boys wanted.
Well, I mean, by 2000-2001 it was, I guess,
yeah, not so many 10-year-olds,
not so many 10-year-olds,
mostly 20 to 30-year-olds, and now we're all in our 50s.
Slight spoiler alert, but we all point out that This is set in 1926. Is that right?
I guess so. I mean, there's a very particular date, and there's a reason that it's using that date. So,
and Houdini. Mm. There are myths and legends about Houdini's death, and this story, let's just say, adds to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, let's just say.
Let's just say.
And I don't know if there are myths and stories about what inspired Lovecraft, because have you? I've read a few of his short stories. And they're kind of okay, but he's a weirdo, definitely. But from what I understand, he was one of those people who basically never left his small town in wherever he lived in the East Coast of America, and seems to have kind of invented, you know, a world that authors have just obsessed with ever since. Like, you know, Grant Morrison and Alan Moore have dipped into the well of Lovecraft stuff plenty of times, as well as Gordon Rennie. So one wonders, it feels like it makes sense that there's a myth of, where would Lovecraft have been inspired to dream up these kind of nameless creatures that could drive you mad?
I'm no expert on Lovecraft, I'm afraid. I would say, obviously, in the last, for most of the 21st century, he seems to be having a moment, doesn't he? You know, there are so many horrors that are based on Lovecraftian stuff, so many TV series. There's even a TV series called Lovecraft Country, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I've not seen that one.
Yeah,
and again, sort of slightly amusingly, one of the features of survival geeks is that they have they encounter some Cthulhu monsters, and like Neil Gouge has managed to render a kind of cuddly, squishy Cthulhu monster toy. And I've now see, I don't suppose they came from that comic, but you can definitely buy Cthulhu plushies.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, lots of people have Cthulhu plushies and little key rings and all sorts of things, which is slightly weird when you think about what Cthulhu is supposed to be. But anyway, Okay, it's splendid. It's a nice, quick read. It's available digitally. Hard copies hard to find now, unfortunately.
No, that's sad. Yeah, I would say if you want to read this, get the old Rebellion printing because it's nice, big.
It
big
does. Sizes. Yeah, it looks. Yeah, you know, you've got the hard copy there, and it looks great. And of course, in that one, you just get the story.
And you get a bit. There's a bit of back matter all from Fraser Irving where he shows some of the kind of work-up sketches that he did. And there's even a sequence that he drew early on that was edited out in the end where I think it's Lovecraft is visited by the ghost of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, right.
You can imagine how that would fit in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, that would be right, wouldn't it?
That certainly makes sense.
Okay.
Are we wanting to spoil the story, or do you think there are enough people who might genuinely not have read it or not remember it?
We can give a spoiler warning if you've got something else you need to say about the story.
I mean, I think it's probably enough to say that like one of the four characters has a sort of a moment of betrayal.
Right.
Because that's tends to what happens when you have a team up.
Yeah.
And also, although I don't know if it's kind of made explicit in the text of the story, another kind of famous figure from the 1920s kind of becomes a kind of a pivotal character later on.
Yeah. Yes, a figure who is also an extremely complicated character.
Yeah.
Would you... Because obviously, as you say, Rennie and Irving moved on from this.
Mm.
Rennie has gone back to his Kabbalistics type stories, but he's never gone back to this.
Well, that's an interesting thought, actually, because there are, if you like, two sort of pseudo-sequels to Necronauts. One of which I've not read, although I've just recently ordered it off Amazon because it was super cheap and second-hand, which is... it's a story about Charles Fort that was written by an American comics guy that I don't know, but drawn by Fraser Irving, that came out a couple of years after Necronauts. So presumably tells the further adventures of Charles Fort.
Oh, okay.
I think it's just called Fort.
Was that an American comic?
It's an American comic,
okay,
yeah.
Right.
And then the other... not sure if it was the very next thing that Rennie and Irving did together, but they did Storming Heaven.
Yes.
And arguably, you know, Necronauts, I can imagine, like, this was great. We've got these four characters that are more or less having an adventure in hell. So Storming Heaven kind of is like the opposite. And again, that uses kind of... Well, mostly Charles Manson is the sort of main famous real person. He's kind of a figurehead of it, but it's sort of exploring, you know, real people in a specific time and place having adventures in the spirit realm.
Hmm.
And it's very much, like, has a thematic similarity to Necronauts. It's a horror story, and it's a massive excuse for Fraser Irving to show off what he can do, and it's he uses a very different style, and it's very much in colour, not in black and white, to try and represent the idea of, like, hey man, drugs expand the mind, and that means you see things in colour. But it's sadly not as good.
And if I remember back to a conversation we had in this pub probably 2 years ago, I think that was sort of on our shortlist, wasn't it?
Stormy Heaven. I mean, it's another one I think people sort of remember it fondly, but it just, whereas Necronauts was like a real short, sharp shock of like, this is just really good.
Yeah.
Stormy Heaven was like, had high hopes because it was the same team and it seemed like a sound idea and the art looked spectacular, but somehow the story just isn't as coherent and satisfying. I don't know.
Okay, so the hard copy, you're going to have to go for second hand to try and find it. The digital version, Tharg's Terror Tales from 2015, still available for $7.99, includes some other stories, A Love Like Blood, Reef of Madness, Mars Needs Mates, these sort of Tharg's Terror Tales, some of which are John Smith, I think, some of which Rennie and Irvin again. I think the art's all Irvin in this collection.
Yes, that would make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, Love Like Blood is like the long, quite a long, slightly longer than Necronauts, and it's vampires and werewolves.
Exactly. Well, it's very, I was going to check the timing because it's very underworld.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think at the time people said, hang on a minute, underworld, have you stolen this idea?
Yeah, and then something else stolen from 2000.
No, again, it's just the idea of putting together vampires and werewolves is not a difficult one to stumble across.
True. And then I think there's some odd one pages at the back which I think appeared in Metal Hammer magazine.
Oh, interesting.
Rather than 2000 AD. But anyway, there you go. So that is available. Let's pretend the art's available.
Do we know if it is?
Well, it's a good question, actually. I always forget to check beforehand whether or not... I mean, I guess these pages must be available. Somebody must have
them. Well, it definitely the case from the back matter of the edition I've got that Irving was using Photoshop tools. So it might be that much of the art exists digitally. And therefore, I don't know, how does the digital art aftermarket work?
You get an NFT. People don't talk about those anymore, do they?
No. Well, except they might now that, you know, Bitcoin is going to become the new currency of America.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I'm sure it sounds like he did draw things on paper or board, but then he probably scanned them in and then did a lot of stuff with Photoshop on top of it. So whether or not there are kind of two different versions of every page that exist, a pre-scanned one and an after one, I don't know.
If he turns up at Lawless next year, I will ask him while I'm getting him to sign something. Okay, let's pick Grail pages. I've been trying to find your Grail page in my digital copy. Let's have a look, see if we can tell us about it.
Well, it's a spoiler page.
Right.
So it's the page where one of the four kind of main characters is confronted as being a traitor. And it's particularly the top panel of the page is a kind of real classic example of Irving using the way he draws lines to show kind of despair and distrust and anguish on the face of this character who says, "How dare you suspect me?"
Right.
And then it kind of moves on for the other characters to kind of, you know, basically threaten them. And there's a classic picture of a person tied up and someone else with a syringe full of truth serum.
I think I found it. Here we are. Yeah. It's page 43 in the digital version. So at the top panel is, as you say, just exactly what you're talking about, the character, and then the use of lines and darkness and light to sort of tell us a little bit something about what's happening to make the character stand out as well. And it's, of course, has it got all the... No, it...
It has
Three of the four on the page, yes.
Anyway, that's. I mean, there were plenty of other pages that I could have picked. In particular, we haven't talked about one thing, which is just a kind of a... For all that it's a horror story, there's an inherent element of kind of fun to it, which is mostly focused around the fact that Charles Fort carries around a cricket bat, which is what he uses to smack down the forces of darkness that are in the real world. And hilariously, whether it's because Irving's never played cricket or whether it's a joke that Fort, being an American, wouldn't know, he's holding it the wrong way around all the time. So
it's a bit Shaun of the Dead. He's got his cricket bat.
Yes, this is definitely a pre-Shaun of the Dead cricket bat.
Whereas Conan Doyle is very much like Dr. Watson, his fictional counterpart, in that he has like his service revolver with him at all times.
I think he's got a cane sword as well.
Cane sword, classic stuff. Okay, so that I think is page 43 in the digital, but I will post it when it comes out. I'll also post that image that we talked about of Houdini sort of struggling to escape from spirit demons or sleep demons or whatever, which is very early on in the book. Any others that you wanted to mention before I show you one of mine?
No, I want to hear yours.
Well,
Is it the face ripping?
No, it's not the face ripping. I'm not very good at choosing the gory pages. Just to put us in time for an episode that's going to come out in December, I think. It's November the 6th.
Yes.
I've chosen page 41, two pages back from your Grail page, which shows a rather horrific image of the Statue of Liberty and the sort of dangers of what America is facing. And I just thought it's a terrific page. So much work done on the inking. Wonderful sort of black silhouette for the Statue of Liberty. Unfortunately, of course, seems like an odd day to have chosen this particular image.
Yes, as the forces of darkness sweep over America, what could possibly prompt
what could
you to
we
think
possibly
about?
Be thinking about the day after the American election as the results come in? Yeah, so I'm going to choose that one and post that one when it comes out as well. I mean, it's remarkable Fraser Irving artwork. It's a great story that cracks along. There's a guy fighting demons with a cricket bat. There's Conan Doyle, there's Houdini, Lovecraft, and everybody in there. There's another. It's the character. We know Edison gets mentioned as the character referred to as the Aviator.
Yes, he's the kind of the other sort of famous figure.
Yeah,
although he's not actually in it that much, but he's quite key.
Yeah,
I think one thing maybe to sort of dwell on a bit is just that Houdini himself is just a brilliant character. Now, again, I'm not a kind of a Houdini scholar, but the way that kind of Rennie sort of delves into his backstory and his motivation, he's just a really fun character to watch. Like, he's a real kind of try anything kind of go-getter of a person.
Yeah.
And he's just a fun kind of action hero to focus on.
He must have cropped up in comics elsewhere, Houdini. You know, he's just, great character.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, excellent. Thanks for picking it, Alex. And thanks for coming back to the pub.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
I hope you actually enjoyed reading it.
I thought it was terrific. I mean, I had read it before, but this time I think I was paying more attention and thinking, oh, this is remarkable.
Do you think it is one that I remember at the time people were like, yeah, this is a great 2000 AD comic, and then because perhaps it is one of the sort of shorter 10 part ones, they don't come up. Like, it reminds me a bit of Chiaroscuro, Cy Spurrier Smudge, was it? Another one that's also a horror story that I really like, that I think people are like, yeah, this is good, and then it's like, but because it doesn't have kind of characters and sequels like that,
yeah,
it sort of fades.
It fades from the memory, doesn't it? Yeah, so they don't stay with us all the time. Terrific. Thank you so much. Well, let's turn to guest projects. We've mentioned Heroes of 2000 AD, the blog, which, as you say, is now...
I have not added new sort of heroes to it for a long time. And I have been kind of slowly updating the sort of tally of how many issues of 2018 and Judge Ray magazine artists and writers have contributed to, which feels sometimes like a little bit of a foolish project, but I quite enjoy it, and at some point I should update the numbers, because it is interesting sort of seeing, you know, some people really have, you know, done hundreds and hundreds of procs, and you think, wow, you know, this comic that we all love wouldn't survive without the people kind of putting it out, and you just think, yeah, and they're all good.
On there, if you go to your profile on that page, you also list various other bits and pieces that you've done around ranking.
Yes, I've never sort of given up just basically loving having an outlet to write about 2000 AD. And for some reason, I seem to have tied it into numerical exercises. So I did a kind of a ranking of all the Judge Dredd epics, where basically I read all of them and kind of gave them notional ratings for the writing and the art and just almost for myself to see what, you know, which I know which ones I enjoy the most, but which ones sort of seem to be vaguely objectively best. So I've done that with the Judge Dredd epics. I've just recently done it with Slane, all of Slane. And I did one of all the end of year Christmas progs, which is quite a kind of a fun one, because I haven't really revisited those as kind of individual progs, but maybe there are people who only read the Christmas ones. And Necronauts indeed is a classic. You know, it's always a good Christmas prog if there's a brand new story in it, and if it's a really good one. And I'm just sort of starting going on a new, slightly kind of impossible ranking on the Judge Dredd magazine.
Right.
Now, I'm not ranking all the issues of the magazine, and I'll wait till it's kind of ready, but I'm kind of rereading a lot of stuff there and kind of working out what was good and what was bad. And this is a slightly more interesting one in a sense, because basically there's quite a lot of bad as well as a lot of very good.
And that's going to pop up on the 2080 forum, possibly?
That's what, you know, I'm not someone who's big into kind of self-promotion and trying to get people away. So I've got like a blogger site just to have a place to host the pictures, really. And then I'll post on the forum to tell people where they can read it if they wish to. And hopefully I'll get some stuff up before Christmas.
Excellent. Well, I will try and post links to your blog stuff and to the 2080 forums. Last time we did a book, it was your own book, of course, Two Heads.
Yes.
Is there another graphic novel about neuroscience at all?
Not about neuroscience. I am working with Dan Locke, the artist. We've been kind of put in touch with a snail scientist. So we are working on a comics project to do with snails. And it's actually, it'll be very different. Sadly, the kind of the market for Two Heads, and I think Two Head style comics, seems not to be particularly vast.
Right.
Which I shouldn't be surprised about. But, you know, it's been translated into a bunch of other languages and sold in other countries. It's kind of fun to see.
So nice.
I'm really proud of it.
But good. Should be.
I am aware that walking into publishing and saying, hey, you know this book that no one bought? I've got another one. Isn't going to work.
Oh, well. Okay. And I'll just mention one other guest project, which I should have mentioned at the top, which is that the last time you were on Megacity Book Club, we were doing Hell Drivers and Damnation Alley.
Right, on the Megacity Film Club.
With Conrad. And actually, I credit you with starting the most, what to me is the most interesting part of the film club, which is revisiting these old films or older films that have somehow seemed to be inspired by British comics or, you know,
Yeah. There's definitely a strand of kind of 2000 AD-esque films.
Yeah.
As well as the films that, you know, that Pat Mills was basically trying to copy for 10-year-olds.
Yeah, the Cribs, as we know, he did in the 70s, yeah. So that's been the most interesting part for me. You know, Conrad and I still...
Have you got a long list of people with...
We have got a long list. Well, I wouldn't say pestering us. We've got a long list of films that we want to get to that we can tie to comics in some way. And some of them are quite interesting. I was talking to you beforehand about, you know, some of them involve multiple time zone recordings, which can be tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
But we will get to them. The film club. The
film club is always fun.
Yeah, we'll be returning. Excellent. Well, thank you again, Alex, for giving up some time in your lunch hour.
Oh, thank you, Eamon, for coming to London.
And thank you to the Betsy Trotwood for letting us go upstairs. I've realised we must be sitting directly over the tube line, and that's what the rumblings are.
It will be. It might even be the Elizabeth line.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Or the Thames Link. There's a lot of they all meet here.
Yeah. Thank you to Alex. Thank you to Betsy Trotwood. Thank you to everyone for listening to Megacity Book Club. As ever, all the links at megacitybookclub.com. We're on all the nice socials, not the nasty one. You can email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, when we're back in the Betsy Trotwood or somewhere else talking about another great book, it's goodbye from me and
Splendid for three.